You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this event on trends in natural disaster response with a particular focus on the role of regional organizations. My name is Beth Ferris. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings and co-director of the Brookings LSE project on, internal displacement. We've been working on the issue of natural disasters, particularly the human rights implications of disasters, really since the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. And today is Earth Day. I hope that you all notice, and so therefore it seems particularly appropriate to talk about this sometimes violent intersection of our planet Earth with human beings with a focus on natural disasters. We have a very distinguished panel to talk with us today. But what I'd like to do first is briefly give you a short 5 or 8 minute overview of the two studies that we're launching today. One of them, I think you hope you all picked up, is our annual review of natural disasters. This is the third year we've done it, and this year it's been written by myself, my colleague Daniel Petz, and Shireen Stark. And a second one that was posted on our website a little while ago really focuses on the role of regional organizations in responding to disasters. I'll just briefly tell you who is up here before I introduce them with a few more words in a few minutes. We have Rose Malango from OCHA. She's the woman in the red suit here. Ian McDonald, who's wearing a more traditional gray suit from American Red Cross. And Cletus Springer of the OAS, who's sitting on my far right. And they all have a lot of experience to share with you about natural disasters in general, and particularly about the challenges and opportunities of working through regional organizations. To begin with our review of disasters in 2012, we began by finding that this was more or less a normal year for disasters. There wasn't a big mega disaster like Haiti in 2010 or the Pakistani floods of the same year, nor was there a major event such as the Japanese earthquake, tsunami, nuclear disaster of 2011. The deadliest disaster of the year was Typhoon Bofa, or Pablo, as it's sometimes called in the Philippines, which killed about 1,200 people with several hundred more missing. Is this microphone working okay? Okay. The deadliest disaster of the year was Typhoon Bofa. The most expensive, as you might imagine, was Hurricane Sandy, which killed about 134 people and caused between 20 and 50, or more recent estimates of up to $65 billion in damages. The disaster that affected the most people was the drought or food insecurity issue in the Sahel, which affected 18 million people. When we looked at the pattern of disasters over the year, we were struck with what we called recurring disasters. You know, Typhoon Bofa was preceded the year before by Typhoon Washi in the Philippines, which hit roughly the same area. Hurricane Sandy followed Hurricane Irene just a little more than a year later. You know, Irene was seen as a once-in-a-hundred-year storm. And a little more than a year later, the same thing happened again with an even stronger storm. And then the 3 years of widespread flooding in Pakistan, 20 million people affected in 2010, 10 million perhaps in 2011, 5 million in 2012. Normally, when a flood affects 5 million people, it would be considered a mega disaster. But this was the third year in a row that Pakistan had experienced this flooding. That led us to look into the question of recurring disasters, or the way in which disasters intersect with each other. Sometimes hazards persist continuously for years. A drought can last for 5 years. It's one drought, but it's a continuous period. Rainfall and heavy rainfall in Colombia persisted for almost a year in 2010. So there are continuous disasters. There are cases when more than one natural hazard occurs within the same year. In 2012, there were 7 Asian nations that experienced at least 2 different kinds of disasters. So Afghanistan had both drought and floods. Bangladesh and Vietnam had both major storms and floods. How do those different types of disasters interacting affect a population. Then there are cascading disasters where one disaster leads to another. So in Japan, you have earthquake, leads to tsunami, leads to nuclear accident. You know, tsunamis always produced by earthquakes, that one causes another. This led us into looking at multi-hazard risks. You know, according to the World Risk Index, the three most vulnerable countries in the world to natural disasters are number one, Vanuatu, Tonga, and the Philippines. All of those are susceptible to typhoons, earthquakes, and volcanoes. Multi-hazards affect populations in different ways and create the need for those planning for both disaster risk reduction and response to work together. We couldn't find a definition of recurring disaster, so we came up with one ourselves, which was the recurrence of the same hazard in the space of a year, in the same region, the space of a year. When disasters recur frequently, and these are not new, we've had recurring disasters since the earliest recorded history, flooding of the Nile, monsoons in South Asia, populations learn to adapt to seasonal variations in weather. But when you have these recurring disasters, the results on the population can be tremendous. People don't have a chance to recover, if you will. Material property is destroyed. Poverty is often the outcome. There are damages to social capital. Kids stay out of school. People lose their jobs. And we see that whether it's in Hurricane Sandy or Hurricane Isaac or some of the other disasters around the world. In looking at these recurring disasters, we noted some common themes. Displacement is common. People are uprooted. Again, whether it's Hurricane Sandy in New York or Typhoon Bofa in the Philippines, people forced to leave their homes, leading to immediate needs for shelter, housing, livelihoods, jobs, and so on. You know, this theme of housing and shelter runs through virtually all disasters in which displacement is an issue. And it always takes longer to find long-term solutions than you think. And it always takes longer for those who are the poorest and most marginalized or vulnerable members of a society. We also found, though, that the policies of governments make a difference. The Philippines, the third most vulnerable country in the world to disasters, has probably the best laws and policies related to disaster management, and also a brand new law on displacement, by the way. The impact of disasters is always a function of not only the intensity of the natural hazard, but also the policies of governments, the ability of societies to cope, vulnerability of population, and so on. We also found that the international community and governments can learn from experience. We've seen, you know, governments that become better and stronger and civil society organizations that are more prepared. Our annual review looked at the particular challenge of wildfires. You know, every year we pick a certain kind of disaster. The first year was volcanoes, last year was droughts, and this year wildfires, which, unlike other hazards like storms or floods or earthquakes or tsunamis, where human beings have very little impact on whether or not a hurricane develops in the Atlantic Ocean or a typhoon in the Pacific, most wildfires are caused by human action. So, for example, in 2011, there were 75,000 recorded wildfires in the United States, 75,000, of which 86% were caused by human action of one kind or another. But human action can also mitigate the impact of those disasters. There are hundreds of thousands of wildfires every year, but in terms of fatalities, the numbers are quite low. So, for example, from 2001 until 2011, a decade, there were only 780 deaths caused by wildfires. But the growth of urban sprawl and the impact of climate change is increasing the likelihood of more wildfires. An increase in the number of homes that are destroyed. In the U.S., for example, in the 1960s, there were about 200 houses a year lost due to wildfires. By the 2000s, it had increased to almost 3,000, from 200 a year to 3,000 a year. Population didn't even double in that time period. And in 2011, a peak of close to 6,000 homes destroyed. there's a mutual relationship or a feedback loop, if you will, between wildfires and climate change. Climate change making at least some parts of the world hotter and drier and more susceptible to wildfires. At the same time, the loss of forests and the degradation of forests increases the greenhouse gas emissions, accounting for some 17% of the world's total. As more people move into forested areas, what they call the wildland-urban interface, the likelihood of wildfires impacting on higher percentages of the Earth's population increases. The third issue we looked at in the report was gender and disasters. And the research there is fairly clear that women are more likely to suffer as a result of disasters because disasters tend to exacerbate existing inequalities or disparities in the population, including gender. But we also note that women have a particular role to play in disaster risk reduction and policies of preventing, responding, and recovering from disasters. So those are some of the highlights of our annual review. We delivered very quickly in a lot of pages in a few minutes. I want to turn now to the other study we did on regional organizations. When you think about disasters, most attention focuses on national governments, or in some cases, local governments. But you really expect your national government to prevent, to respond, help you recover when disaster occurs. For countries in which national capacity is limited, international organizations play a particularly important role. We have somebody here from OCHA, and there's the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. But the role of regional organizations, African Union, Organization of American States, ASEAN, and hundreds of others, has received relatively little attention from scholars in the international community. Globally, the number of regional organizations is skyrocketing. There are hundreds and thousands of regional organizations formed for many different reasons, with different objectives, different membership, and so on. Regions can act as a bridge between the national and the international. A regional response may be quicker than an international one just for reasons of geography. It may be culturally more appropriate to have somebody from your region respond than somebody from a distant place. It may be politically more acceptable. We saw in 2008 the key role played by ASEAN in bridging a difference with the international community and the government of Myanmar and responding to Cyclone Nargis. There are lots of different patterns of regional organizations. In some, such as Africa, you have a big tent African Union with most African states members of the African Union along with sub-regional organizations. In Asia, you don't have a big tent organization. You have a multitude of regional or sub-regional organizations. Then you've got bodies that weren't established for any role in disaster risk management, but rather for other purposes that are called on when a disaster happens. So, for example, the Pan American Health Organization wasn't set up as a disaster response entity, but when a disaster happens in the Americas, it plays a very active role. We did a desk study of about 30 regional organizations, trying to find out what they do, how they compare, what makes them more effective, what are the challenges. We developed a list of 17 indicators. It's on the little two-page summary that you received to do more systematic analysis of some 13 of them. Does a region have regular meetings? They all have meetings. Meetings seem to be an easy step to take to begin to work together on disaster issues. Do they have regional rapid response mechanisms? 5 of them do. A regional insurance scheme? 2 of them do, and so on. We find that international organizations have played an important role in stimulating the growth of these regional bodies. We find different patterns of frameworks. There are only 3 regional treaties that deal with disaster risk management as their primary issue in South Asia, Caribbean, and Asia. We find that there's a trend toward creating distinctive organizations or response mechanisms or centers within the regions to provide that specialized knowledge. And in this regard, Latin America and the Caribbean have moved much faster and developed, much earlier, I should say, in developing these entities. very interesting tendency of developing common risk pooling mechanisms, disaster risk insurance. Relatively few of these regional bodies actually provide cash assistance after a disaster occurs. Much more attention is needed, and from our part, we've commissioned research on the Pacific and the Caribbean to look at those regional mechanisms, thinking that perhaps small island states in different parts of the world might have some more features in common. Very curious about the interface between national governments and regional bodies. What do national governments expect regional bodies to do? And more generally about the overall division of labor. Are there some things that internationals do better? Some things only the national government can do? What is the role of regional bodies in this complex relationship? The relationship between military and civilian actors at the regional level is another one would be interesting to explore. And finally, does cooperation on disasters, whether preventing, responding to, or recovering from, does that kind of cooperation lead to better prospects for peace, security, cooperation in other fields? Is there a spillover effect and not to go into international relations terms, but is there kind of a functional logic here? So those are some of the issues that we explored in our study on regional organizations, which turned out to be much more time-consuming, but also much more interesting than we expected when we began. But let me stop now and turn to our distinguished panelists. And what we'd like to do is, I'm sorry, this looks kind of formal with this table and drapes, but I want you all to imagine that we're sitting in a living room, we've got a cup of coffee, we're leaning back, we're talking informally with each other, and just ask you each first, just tell us a little bit about what you do, and very briefly, and then let's have a conversation about some of these issues. Rose, would you like to start? Who are you and where do you work?
Thank you very much for that introduction. Definitely would have to remove my boots to be in my living room, but do my best to imagine that. My name is Rosa Malango, and on June 5th, 2013, I would have been 19 years and a half working in humanitarian assistance around the world. As I was just mentioning before coming up here, at times it didn't feel like a blessing. Now I realize I'm blessed with the knowledge of having lived through all those crises to be able to do the work that I do today. The Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Valerie Amos, decided to entrust me a year and 3 months ago with the work of partnership development. And she thought that I needed to do this because we realized there was a global shift. Our partners had changed. Member states' positioning was changing. Regional organizations were changing. Private sector was coming in. And we needed to get a better understanding of this amalgamation, this community of power and resources coming to the fore, which in some places is known as the Global South. So I spent a lot of my time trying to understand what are the dynamics, what is the knowledge that's available, what are the opportunities for engaging better between us and the United Nations and these emerging communities. Right now, as I speak to you, I was delighted to see that out of the 13 organizations, all of them are priority organizations for us, and we use different indicators. We have a very strong relationship with ASEAN and a lot of their subsidiary bodies, with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, that has now become the League of Arab States, African Union, ECOWAS, the Economic Community, West African States, Southern Africa. The only ones I saw that was missing there was the International Community of the Great Lakes, which we also work very closely on. I saw all the colleagues in Latin America that we work with. The one platform I did not see mentioned is what they call MIA, which is a partnership framework which brings all the regional organizations together. And this year we will be meeting in Jamaica in early June to have a discussion about what are the capabilities, what are the operations, what are the priorities and commitments going forward. Two words that I would like to put out there before we get into the question and answers, which I'm really looking forward to. When people ask me what have I noticed that has changed, I guess one of our biggest challenges as an institution is that humanitarian crisis has changed. What constitutes a humanitarian situation, what constitutes a natural disaster has changed. It's been an evolution. When we started, it was mostly, you know, civil war, rebels, landmines, demobilization, a flood every 50 years, you were good to go. Not anymore. Whatever you think can't happen, happens. We have found ourselves compelled to be involved in situations that started off as human rights situations, protection crisis. Next thing, we're there. Increasingly, we find ourselves in the country for one reason, only to be hit by an earthquake, a flood, and drought. Every single time I've gone out to a community, the elders always tell me that something is wrong. I used to be my great-great-grandchildren that would experience what I experience. I have lived through a drought twice. So in real human terms, it's wrong, and it doesn't. The coping mechanisms are not there, and we as a community need to adjust our coping mechanisms because everything is happening much faster. Another thing that I have noticed is that it can happen to anyone. There is no such thing as it only happens to this type of countries or that type of countries. We had Sandy right here, which, crazily enough, shut us down, the world crisis management organization, for a couple of hours. That was scary. It happened to Japan. It happened to anyone. So that sense of we are all in it together, and hence we need to figure this out as a global community. I think it's something critical that has shifted. The second thing that I've noticed also is the transformation across organizations. The regional organizations increasingly have seen themselves as part of the first line of response. And first line of response to anything. So what constitutes a risk or a trigger for response? It could be civil war, it could be a coup d'etat, it could be the floods, it could be a locust arrived. They see themselves as needing to have the knowledge and the capacity to respond. And increasingly what they're asking from us is expertise, knowledge, best practices for them to have their own funding tools, their own rapid response team, their own policies. They're adapting and absorbing really, really quickly everything that we have to offer. I've also noticed more what I call knowledge transfer. Increasingly, Brazil invites me to something where they are hosting a workshop for Qatar and Mozambique. They're already exchanging experiences on how they use their military assets, how they use the civil defense forces, how they use the private sector to prepare and respond to disasters. So one of the biggest challenges is to make sure we're talking about the same thing. Because many times we go with our checklist, we don't see the stuff because they just don't call it the same way. Disaster management, humanitarian assistance gets hidden under sustainability, stability, all sorts of things, solidarity. So really that need to have a profound in-depth conversation with people to make sure you understand what they have and what they're doing. I think the very last thing that I've seen are challenges becoming opportunities. We've been talking a lot about population growth and technology. I think population growth is an incredible opportunity. Particularly for women and particularly for the youth. But how do we use our systems and our tools to make sure they're part of the conversation early enough and they can plug in with their added value? This is where it's at. So looking forward to having a discussion. And also technology. The good thing is, I think for a while we thought technology was seen by a lot of countries as something negative. It's not. It's being embraced. So what are we doing with that? And it's coming from anywhere. There's a young kid in South Africa coming up with something, a lady in Ghana coming up with something, a guy in Bangkok. But what do we do? How do we take these beautiful examples of innovation that happen in a village in the middle of nowhere and scale them up so that the world can see them and benefit from them? Thank you.
Thank you, Rose. A lot of questions to continue discussing. But let's turn to Cletus, who's director of the Department of Sustainable Development at the OAS.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here. I want to acknowledge the presence of my colleagues, Pablo Gonzalez and Michael, who have joined us from the Department of Sustainable Development. We've been around for more than 44 decades, working on what we regard as an integrated approach to sustainable development that involves work in water resources management. It involves work in natural hazard risk management. It involves work in energy, sustainable energy, environmental law, as well as in land management. And so these five thematic areas of our work enabled us to make a claim, which I would like to think it's a claim that we support, that we have an integrated approach to dealing with not only any one of these areas, but all of these areas taken as a total. And so we are able to look at the cross impacts of dynamics in one of these thematic areas on another. For example, in the case of risk management, disaster risk management, we were able to look at water and the hydrological cycle and changes in climate change and what that means for land management, for example, or what it means for population dynamics and rural urban drift and things of that sort. Similarly, in the context of energy, we were able to look at droughts and the effects that droughts will have on electricity and the effects of that on economic development and private sector activity and so on. So we are able to take a comprehensive view, as comprehensive as circumstances allow, to these dynamics. Within the Organization of American States, we have a number of tools and instruments that we leverage almost on a daily basis to help us to do our work in this particular area. Very recently, our member states approved an inter-American plan for disaster management, so that we have not that now as a mandate that we are actively executing. We also have an inter-American national disaster mitigation network, or Inter-American Disaster Mitigation Network, INDM, which is a network of professionals. It's a network of agencies, and it's a network of ideas, exchange, information exchange, learning exchange, and things of that sort. It's been around now for almost 7-8 years, and it is the premium vehicle that we're using within the Department of Sustainable Development to advance learning in the hemisphere on disaster management, risk management issues. We also have as a tool the Inter-American Committee on Natural Disaster Reduction, which is a committee that is headed by our Secretary General, and it includes the leadership of the World Bank, of the Inter-American Development Bank, and the Pan American Health Organization, the Pan American Institute for Geography and History, and a couple of others. We have had a series of hemispheric encounters that we hold from time to time within the hemisphere, where we bring the practitioners and decision makers in risk management and development in particular. We bring them together every so often to look at best practice in this evolving field, and to share the best practice with each other. Right now, we are doing work in early warning systems in Central America and the Caribbean. We have a White Helmets facility, which is a facility that is funded by the government of Argentina, which takes us more into the response mode of disasters than we are configured to do now. We are mostly in the preparedness and risk management mode of disaster management. But that's basically how we are set up right now to intervene in this area. And I'll come back and tell you more about the findings of our work in a short while.
Thank you, Cletus. And Ian with American Red Cross. No, that's not the title. I know. You tell us what you do.
Okay, thank you. Yes, my name is Ian O'Donnell. I work with the American Red Cross on a new initiative called the Global Disaster Preparedness Center that the American Red Cross is hosting together with the IFRC, really on behalf of the Red Cross, Red Crescent Network, to be a hub for knowledge and innovation around disaster preparedness. I think this topic of you know, regionalization and regional organizations is really close to our hearts also. I mean, I think, you know, for many organizations, there's this constant tug between centralization and decentralization. And I think, you know, regional organizations play a nice role in the midst of that kind of dynamic tension. And certainly with the center we're working with at the Red Cross, this notion of peer relations between Red Cross societies and between countries, between communities is critical and important. You know, I think a lot of our efforts, we're looking at things like new technology, you know, where we can promote more peer-to-peer learning, where we can look at how to scale up, you know, new kinds of access to preparedness information using things like mobile phone apps and using SMS messaging. I mean, these are all great tools to help spread information. And it's interesting to think about, I mean, just the common, I guess, risk patterns and risk profiles that countries face in distinct regions of the world and what opportunities there are for sharing learning and insights in that sense. You know, I think for us in the Red Cross, this is an important component of how the Red Cross can work with other partners, whether those are civil society partners, national government partners, local government. You know, to look at opportunities for where these commonalities exist, where there's opportunities to look at transboundary kind of risk issues, where there's opportunities to look at disaster impacts that spill over our national boundaries. You know, while 2012 may have been an average year for disasters, I think 2011 showed us, particularly with the Thai floods and the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, that there can be really widespread impacts too from disasters, that disasters are no longer localized in many ways, that we feel those impacts around the world. You know, that with all of our other great benefits of globalization, one of the other things we're inheriting is more and more dependency, actually, in the way our markets and our systems are linked, so that disasters that happen in one place really can have a widespread effect, you know, particularly in the region they happen in, but also in other parts of the world as well. Yes, I think for the Red Cross, yeah, this is an important topic that, you know, I think we're quite interested to see how we can work more with other partners, really how we use these opportunities of regional organizations and settings to convene different sets of partners. I mean, the organizations that are part members of regional organizations are often members of lots of other organizations internationally as well. I mean, one of the interesting questions is, what is the added value that comes from that regional activity, you know, that's afforded to those national governments or to, in our case, national societies for the Red Cross to participate regionally and, you know, see where they can see opportunities to encourage more partnering, you know, that maybe there's a way, like a buffering role potentially, that these kind of regional organizations play. And they also give us a little bit of cover, actually, to interact with the partners where there may be normal day-to-day tensions. This whole notion of disaster diplomacy is quite interesting. And I think that the example of Cyclone Nargis in the Myanmar, the role that ASEAN played there was, I mean, quite particular, but also very interesting just to see, you know, what was actually at work politically and how did that operate. So I think, yeah, we're very interested to have this discussion, and we thank you for the invitation.
Thanks. Well, picking up on what you said about the added value of regional organizations as we sit around the coffee table here, let me ask all of you, what do you think is the regional added value of regional organizations? Are we going to see more involvement of regional organizations in disaster risk management?
I think we will. I think regional organizations have to create economies of scale. And for smaller countries in the Caribbean, for example, there are 14 member states from the Caribbean that are members of the Organization of American States. They don't have the means within their own spaces to deal with the problems of disasters that they face ever so often. And so what they have done is the next natural thing is to agglomerate and come together on the regional groupings. And so you have within the Caribbean, the Caribbean Disaster Mitigated Agency of the Caribbean, called CEDIMA, which is familiar, I think, to many of you. We have several examples of regional groupings in the Americas. There's separate ANAC in Central America and a couple of others. I think if I'm to put my finger on the most important contribution that regional organizations play is to kind of operate as a sort of central node in the diffusion of learning. That's the one thing. That's on the preventive side of things. And also as a coordinating node to move assistance, and I'm talking now on the response mode, to move assistance to hardship areas that have been affected by disasters. But I expect that role to expand. I think you're going to find regional organizations playing an even more strategic role in helping the countries to build the capacity to build their awareness of the issues and so on, and to move best practice knowledge around.
Thank you. I think that I totally share that analysis. And if I start from the premise that we all agree that in today's world nobody can resolve these issues by themselves, then I see three levels of engagement for the regional organizations. One is just in redefining the partnerships, because they are closer to the countries that are affected. They are closer to the communities. So the whole thing of what do I need from the UN, if anything? What do I need from the European Union? What do I need from USAID? They are going to redefine that, because that is where the conversations happen behind closed doors among themselves. And I take here an example of ECOWAS, the Economic Community for West African States, where they regularly have floods followed by drought, followed by everything. And recently we've been finding in the past 5 years, if you do an analysis, when they come to ask for assistance, it's becoming longer and longer. Before, within 24 hours, my phone would ring. Now it's actually several weeks after. What has happened? They asked us for UNDAC training. We trained them on United Nations Disaster Assessment and Coordination. They know our modalities. They know our tools. They have created their own emergency response teams. ECOWAS has those, so they deploy them. They've already adopted a humanitarian policy, which was adopted last year at the HESA summit level, based on the UN humanitarian policy. So they have a legal framework to be able to do that. So they're going further and further away from what is it that they need and when they need it from us. So I see them defining policy. I see them redefining the partnerships. And I do see them becoming part of the first and second tier response when things happen. Thank you.
Rosa, would you think that eventually regional organizations will take on many of the functions that the internationals now play? Will the growth of regional organizations mean we no longer need these big international agencies?
And I can take early retirement? I wish. I think that it's already happening. And I think that that is why you hear a lot about reform within the United Nations. We are redefining ourselves to the 21st century. It is no longer about creating awareness about the services and the tools, interagency standing committee, common needs assessments, joint planning, joint resource mobilization, common pool funds. They have it. They're doing it. Then it becomes, what is our role? And I think that our role will remain being the custodians of the rules and procedures, the rules of engagement. Because even though it's really nice, sometimes there can be still tensions within, and when that happens, they turn towards us. I think that also in terms of economy of scale, unfortunately, there will still be disaster at a certain level that even the region can cope, where what is a region becomes a confusion. Right now, we have the drought in the Sahel. It covers west, central, northern Africa. Who comes in for that? So there they find themselves, all of them coming to the UN. Can you please help us? I think that also we will be there to help with the knowledge transfer you're talking about. Many times I encourage the government of Nigeria to sit down with Brazil to learn directly from Brazil how they've been doing preparedness and response. So they come to us to figure out where they can find the knowledge and the expertise to improve their own capabilities of response. So we'll have a custodians and a knowledge management sort of a role, but the actual need to respond hopefully will reduce to when it's a mega disaster.
Thanks. Ian?
I wanted to pick up on Rose's early point about just the sheer amount of increasing capacity in many countries. You know, I think in answer to your question, in many ways, I think it's not so much a role shifting from international level to a regional level as it's a different role that's developing. You know, I think, you know, at least within the Red Cross, I think probably within a broader set of organizations, we're right now in the midst of a really fundamental shift from kind of a traditional international assistance model to a model that's much more based on mutual aid and solidarity. You know, that countries really have more and more capacity. You know, we saw this after the Indian Ocean tsunami where Thailand, India, you know, initially refused assistance because they didn't want to be asking for assistance, right? They felt they had capacity, you know, and it took weeks or months actually for those countries to see the benefit of taking on some of the resources that were being raised internationally and to have it cast in a different model. The same with the U.S. after Hurricane Katrina. You know, we don't want to be asking for assistance internationally. We have the capacity. you know, I think more and more this is something that we need to switch to, this kind of recognize this mutual aid or solidarity role to it. And I think in that sense, too, it's easy for regional organizations to help play a facilitating role or enabling role for that. If they can help kind of guide and buffer, in some sense, the national governments, the countries, when they're experiencing disasters. I mean, the other thing is you get overrun with offers of assistance, you know, and wading through it, at least in the Red Cross side, it's like a 24-hour-a-day task almost just to deal with all the different organizations that are coming to assist, no less all the people in your own country that have already been affected. You know, so the question of, like, how do we help buffer that and make these offers of assistance more constructive and productive? You know, I think regional organizations will play a larger role in that in the future, really in guiding this solidarity and mutual aid, but in a way that's fundamentally different from the way international assistance has worked in the past. You know, so I think in some sense it's more of an evolution, you know, that we're seeing evolve and develop.
Any downsides or challenges of having regional organizations be more involved?
Well, I think certainly the role of regional organizations is not to do for the national constituents the things that they can do for themselves. That ought to be the first rule of thumb. The second rule of thumb is not to duplicate, to replicate rather than to duplicate. The third rule of thumb is to recognize when it is the appropriate time to step back and allow for the national agencies to assume a stronger role as the capacity improves. The fourth rule of thumb, I would say, is to create a framework of order around which order and predictability around which the relationship between the national levels and the regional levels can operate. And in the OAS, we have had many years of setting these timelines. Of course, they've been tested all the time, because you have, in the midst of the emergence of these regional organizations, they tend to emerge alongside the rise of political structures, and political structures that are themselves that carry some sovereignty overspill, you know, into them. So that Separate ANAC, for example, just to use an example, is not just Separate ANAC. Separate ANAC is a vestige of a regional, sub-regional, regional grouping, political grouping. And so that now interplays with the Organization of American States, which also includes the very same member states that created Separate ANAC. But so you have these kinds of, I don't want to call them tensions, but you have these indicators of the need to manage the relationship in a much more respectful and productive kind of way.
What about politics? Can't politics limit the ability of a regional body to respond?
Absolutely.
Oh, God. Speaking as the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, knowing that my colleagues are in political affairs and peacekeeping and Security Council, challenges. I think there are three challenges. One is just communication. Don't we overestimate that and take that for granted until a crisis hits? We're not speaking about the same thing. It is so important to have a clear discussion about roles and responsibilities, definition of crisis, what is it we're talking about, when will we come in, before it's a problem. When it's a problem, I can't hear you, you can't hear me, and it can become a diplomatic incident in all of 2 seconds. So I find communication to be really, really important, because otherwise it's the perfect opportunity for misperceptions to become a global crisis. And it can be seen as interference. You're trying to tell them what to do. You're not respecting. So the whole communication on priorities, roles, and responsibilities is critical for me to happen before the crisis. The second challenge that I find is decision-making. And this is where the political component comes in. Who makes the decisions? Because many times we find it's the driver states. But the driver states for the African Union are the same states that are on the Security Council who may be upset about something that has nothing to do with my floods. But because they're upset about the thing to do with my flood, suddenly they're not letting my UN disaster assessment team land and they won't let me give money to the NGOs to respond. So we have this thing where you need to constantly be aware of what are the political tensions in that region, even though it's none of your business. You need to know what's happening economically. You need to know what's happening politically. You need to know in terms of security and terrorism. I had to become an expert just to know what might hit you, what might influence or create a misperception in terms of decision-making. Because at the end of the day, the decision is made by a head of state, it's made by a prime minister, it's made by a minister somewhere. So really important that we are aware of that. The third challenge I find is the connectivity of systems. We tried for the longest time from the UN, we thought that what we needed to do was to bring the regional organizations into our tent. Some of them don't want to, and the tent may not be big enough. So we've changed to now what we need to do is have a better understanding of the different systems and how can we connect. Where are the points where we connect? We have a common sense of purpose and we can respond. That is a humongous challenge. There's language barriers, there's different rationale for those systems having been created as compared to ours. There is some regional organizations that don't think that the UN, the global law framework supersedes theirs, national versus global. So those are some of the challenges that we are faced with them trying to assert themselves and play a more robust role. Ian?
There's also a chance, I think, that we may miss certain opportunities with regional organizations. Like, it's interesting to me to look at the rise of concern around urbanization and the role of cities in particular, mm-hmm. And wondering if maybe we shouldn't focus exclusively on regional organizations of national states. In some sense, maybe we should be looking at regional organizations that bring in other actors, that bring in cities, municipal governments, that bring in political leaders at that level, civil society organizations. As an example, I would mention, some of the things that the paper looked at in terms of the risk transfer play out this way a little bit, where regions have different needs, I think, quite clearly. And the places where there's been success so far in thinking about regional risk pools in the Caribbean and the Pacific, these are places with small island states that have limited access to insurance markets. If you look at, even though I know ASEAN in the past has flirted with the notion of a regional risk pool, the Philippines and Indonesia could walk out any day they want and get reinsurance or float a cat bond on a market if they were interested. So I think in some sense, there won't be standard services and solutions that you can offer to countries in different regions necessarily. But I would think there might be interesting opportunities to get city governments involved and think about how they would think about this, that they actually, might have a need or an appetite for that kind of coverage, paralleling what's occurring in the Caribbean, but just at a different level of governance, essentially.
Interesting. Well, moving a bit beyond the regional issues, some of the other issues that we found in our report were recurring disasters, the impact of disasters on women, the role that gender plays in disaster risk reduction response. Would you like to offer any comments on that before we open it up to the other people in our living room?
Absolutely. And I'll take my second cup of coffee on that one, the latte. Women. I really think that too many times, and guilty myself of this at the beginning of my relief worker career, they are the victims. Actually, no. They are the first responders when a disaster strike. The challenge that I find is, what do we do to make sure that they're part of the contingency planning? What do we do to make sure they're part of the business continuity plans that happen, whether it's the local level, provincial, national, regional, or global? How do we make sure that the Women's Markets Association have given us their input about what's going to happen with the roads and infrastructure? Because guess what? When something shuts down, they know how to get stuff. But nobody has contacted them to make the contingency plan. Nobody has contacted them when we made our security risk assessment. And guess what? When the borders allegedly closed, they know how to get across to make sure the children are safe. They have links with family members on the other side of the borders. I remember going down to Cote d'Ivoire in the middle of the crisis, and everybody telling me, oh, no, you can't go. There's nothing moving. We left our UN car way back and just walked through a lot of mud and water and no bridges and everything. I found people moving. And most of them were women and children. So I sat down on a rock and had a conversation. They have been moving in back and forth because they use the family ties. So how do we empower women, take into consideration their coping mechanisms so that they can play a robust role in their little space to contribute to mitigation and response to disasters. I think we need to look at that first and foremost, and then we can also look at the fact that, of course, if they don't have access to markets, if there's no electricity, they'll be the first ones, they'll be the victims of violence, and they'll be the first ones to suffer because they will not be able to provide the basic services for their children.
I would like to make a point about the private sector, which I have to admit, even in the OAS arrangements, we have not reached out to the private sector as much as we possibly can. Because if you consider the metrics that while mortality has been declining, mortalities from disasters has been declining, the economic impact of disasters has been increasing. And that economic impact is largely residing, if you might use that term, within the private sector arrangements. How do we get the private sector to get involved beyond the issues of risk transfer and so on? Because business continuity planning, business planning, very rarely do we see natural hazard risk factors taken into account in the design of business plans, for example. Very rarely do we have businesses with contingency plans for bouncing back from disasters when they do occur. How involved is the business community in reducing the risk profile, their own risk profile, and by extension the risk profile of the countries in which they operate? And I would suggest as well that the risk transfer, the cost of insurance premiums and so on in many countries are a function of the high risk profiles of the businesses themselves. And so we have to, I think, work more with the private sector to bring about a better balance in that situation. And the only way to do that is to get them more integrally involved.
I think particularly, too, in the restoration of livelihoods and jobs, the private sector has a role to play that sometimes humanitarian agencies don't even think about. Ian?
I think it's – actually, I really like the point about the private sector as well. And I think one of the challenges maybe thinking about how we think about recurring disasters, too, is how do we both recognize the accumulating impacts of recurring disasters but still keep our minds open to worst-case scenarios that are still possible. And I think certainly this is something when we talk to the private sector, understanding like what kind of scenarios can really impact them. You know, I think again, the floods in Thailand in 2011, the Fukushima earthquake and typhoon showed a lot of that. I think the one, you know, hazard that still become maybe slipped out of our consciousness and become a bit of a sleeper issue is a pandemic. You know, and I think understanding like what some of the true threats around pandemic are in the future and how that might affect the private sector is certainly a kind of a risk and a scenario that should unify us in some of our planning and thinking, just because of the wide range of its impacts and our inability really to protect on a national boundary basis, you know, what's happening. And so, we're really exposed then on a quite regional basis often, you know, for what's happening in the countries around us and how that increases our exposure or vulnerability.
Well, thank you all. We could ask a lot more questions up here, but I'm sure that you have questions as well. So why don't we open it up for discussion? We have about 35 minutes and people standing by with microphones, please, up here in the front. And then the woman, maybe we'll take several questions at once. And please identify yourself, too.
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. To what extent have you been able to use the Internet in holding meetings with regional organizations and getting their commitments?
Great. Okay, we'll take the woman back here.
Hi, Shannon Scribner with Oxfam America, and thank you for your presentations. I had a question on the shift that we're talking about in terms of regional organizations, but also national governments and local actors, and where we think the trend is going on funding. We have a whole chapter in here on funding, but right now it's, you know, UN agencies that are getting the funding, and then it's the INGOs as well. So what's the trend on the funding going directly to regional organizations, national governments, local NGOs on the ground?
Thank you. Another question over here, please.
Excuse me. Thank you. I'm Jean-Baptiste Migren from the Global Facility for Disaster Risk Reduction and Recovery. And we are managing on behalf of the European Union. I don't know if somebody is representing European Union here. We are managing on their behalf the ACP EU program, which part of the funding goes directly to support regional economic communities. And we've seen a good trend in the Pacific in the funding is directed in priority for Africa, Caribbean, and Pacific. And the support from GFDR to them is really just starting, but we've seen a very strong interest from their side, specifically on improving land use planning, building codes, and harmonizing public policies across the countries. So I think most of the debate here has been focusing on strengthening contingency planning and preparedness. I would really like also to hear from you also if you see a trend in, of course, not, keeping the right level of responsibilities and competencies between national and regional governments, how you see a trend in harmonizing public policies for disaster risk management and, mainly on the prevention side.
Thanks. We'll take one more at the back there, and then we'll turn it over to the panel and then come back with another round.
Hi, I'm Alice Thomas from Refugees International. I have two questions. Sorry. The first is whether you see the potential for regional bodies, if they're not already doing so, to play a monitoring or accountability role. I think we've recognized that regardless of whether there are disaster management frameworks in place, often people get left out of the disaster response process. My second question, this I think is touched on in the book, Beth, but I'm wondering if you can comment on the role of regional organizations in better managing displacement from natural disasters.
Okay, we've got questions on the role of the Internet in communicating with regional organizations, trends in funding toward regional bodies, the question of managing funds for disaster risk reduction or mitigation strategies, role of regional bodies in monitoring, and regional bodies in displacement. I'll see who wants to answer which ones. Don't feel like you have to answer them all. First one gets to pick and choose. Lead us.
Just to go to the one on harmonization of public policies, I think this is perhaps the critical role for regional organizations to take on. We are seeing more and more that the vulnerability that exists at the national level in many countries is a vulnerability that is aligned with poor governance. And by poor governance, I mean institutional policy and institutional arrangements that rather than build resilience, deepen vulnerability because they're not things like zoning plans, proper zoning plans in place. They're not sufficiently well-designed risk profiles. These countries don't have the benefit of access to tools, for example, geographic information systems and early warning systems and things of that sort, that will help them to reduce the overall cost of disasters. And that is why we are seeing an upsurge in the economic impact of these disasters in the region. And I frankly believe, and this is what we've been working on in the OES, ever since we became involved in this area. And that is really to work with the governments to help them to all rise to a common level of competence in dealing with these issues and helping them to learn from each other. I mean, across the Americas, you will find variations in the strengths and weaknesses of national governments in dealing with these things. And it might surprise you to find that even in some of the weakest economies or countries with the weak economies, there are nuggets of wealth of knowledge and information that can be used and brought to the fore that can be shared with the richer countries who are not informed of these things. And we were told recently of the role of women and the things that women come up with. On the monitoring and accountability side, we do play a role in this. We could play a heavier role. Where we go in a lot of post-disaster assessment roles, and we do studies of what went wrong, what went right, and we try to combine these studies in what we call learning. We diffuse that through our networks, and we bring the countries together in hemispheric encounters where we share with them and help them to share with each other these best practices and bad practices and so on. So, but in terms of working towards a common standard or indicators of measuring progress against a common line of action, you are aware, I'm sure, of the HUMA framework of action, which the UNISDR adopted back in 2005, I think it was. But we are now working on with the UNISDR in building the indicators for measuring progress in the implementation of the HFAs. And we're seeking to do a similar thing with our own Inter-American plan that we designed very recently.
Hey, Rosa or Ian?
Okay. Let me start backwards, because most of the stuff we've just been working on, luckily enough. First, on the issue of the role of regional organizations in displacement, this is definitely something that's been a topic we've been discussing for the last 2 years very intensely. To my recollection, right now, all we have, the only regional entity, because not all of them have an overarching one, as you mentioned, the African Union adopted the Kampala Convention. It's the only legally binding comprehensive framework by a regional entity that covers roles and responsibility in displacement, both for the member states as well as for the regional economic bodies. We're extremely excited because we worked with the Red Cross to help develop it and have it adopted. It was recently ratified, so now it's each nation is bringing it into their national laws. So that is the only big body we have there. With the other regional entities, it's much more informal discussions about what are the existing guidelines, what are the existing arrangements, roles and responsibilities to respond. On monitoring and accountability, here again, we've had to do it very specific by organization. There's no such thing as one size fits all. One thing that has helped us has been coming up with joint action plans, because then we can come up with joint monitoring frameworks, performance frameworks. So this is helping us in each region. We have one with ECOWAS, with SADC, with AU, with ASEAN, with OIC, with the League of Arab States. We're updating it this week. So that gives an opportunity to have a common discussion on monitoring and performance. What it also does is help donors such as the EU to also see what is the value for the investment that they're making. So we discuss with the donors, and then we come up with a joint performance framework. It is nascent. There's a lot of work to do going forward, but at least those frameworks are there. On the issue of roles and responsibility and policies and prevention, states versus regional organizations, I just thought it was very interesting. We actually experienced it from those two perspectives. Don't forget that these same states come to have that same discussion within the General Assembly. So they have to decide where they want that policy discussion. So we find out that sometimes some of the states actually just want a global treaty, or they actually want a regional arrangement. So we have to keep track to figure out what is in their interest and why is that in their interest. But we see it very frequently that sometimes somebody wants something in the General Assembly, so he starts by pushing it through his regional organization. And next thing, there's a letter to the Secretary General saying this is a priority, and it comes to the General Assembly. So the role is definitely there. If I think it will help my nation, I have my neighbors pitch in, and then I go to my partners, and we take it into a global framework. Shifting on funding, I think that for us, the biggest challenge here is where is the new funding going to come from? And here, what we're finding a lot is that for the regional organization, the funding for preparedness, they're calling it something else to be able to tap into other sources. So that the traditional humanitarian financing is not going into preparedness, despite the fact that we all say $1 in preparedness is more than $7 in response, not happening. So they're going into the bilateral discussions. They're going into bonds. They're going into the development banks to be able to finance preparedness. Hence, they call it solidarity. So within that chapeau in there, they're trying to figure out financing. Good news, they're emulating our practices. So I spend a lot of my time with these organizations explaining to them the SURF, the pool funds. They want to use our mechanisms so that they can track and report on the financing that comes in and who does what with it. Last but not least, the use of the internet. I think that the most interesting part here is that definitely technology has improved 1,000 times the way we work and interact with our colleagues around the world. We're able to have video conferences. We are able to show, to do joint designs of reports. We're able to post reports in different languages concurrently. The most recent example was the day before yesterday, we actually recognized for the first time the first ever pledge by Kuwait to the United Nations in response to complex emergency Syria. We had done a conference in January. They didn't want to give us the money. They wanted to give it to their NGOs. They gave it to us. We were able to use the internet and the website to make sure it was launched in New York, Abu Dhabi, Geneva at the same time in English, French, and Arabic. Hence, they're happy, relationship solidified, other OIC member states to contribute.
Are there any questions left?
I'm not sure they're left, but I was going to make one quick point on the funding. I think one way to think of this, too, is not necessarily can regional organizations attract additional funding and channel additional funding, but maybe what role can regional organizations play in helping countries better understand funding? I think particularly understanding, too, like the funds that are already being invested in development processes locally. I think we still focus very much on kind of international assistance flows and humanitarian assistance. We still focus too much on foreign direct investment. I mean, there's so much money that's being invested locally that has a key role to play in risk reduction and prevention that I think there's a lot we could do to help countries see that better. And the Philippines is a great example, actually. The key part of the change that's happened with their 5% budget set aside in local governments is really this, it's a catastrophe fund for local governments that basically just required each local government to set aside that 5% originally just for response. And over time, they broadened that to also enable them to make risk reduction investments in that. But it didn't involve any additional budgeting of funds by the national government. In essence, all they did was kind of task the local governments to pay attention to this and begin to address it. And it wasn't probably the first 7 or 8 years it existed, it was purely a response fund. It was only over time that people gradually saw the logic of expanding it and beginning to use it for risk reduction measures. So I think, helping countries unpack some of these examples and understand them better and see what might be relevant. How does a solution that was developed in the Philippines with a particular style and type of decentralization, how could that map over to other countries in the region? I think this is a key thing that regional organizations could help play. I mean, to really kind of supplement that learning process and help countries, ask the right kind of research questions to adapt these kind of programs and policies in their own countries.
Thanks. We also tried to look at the funding, but simply couldn't find the data. It's not publicly available how much regional organizations are spending on disaster issues. And I should point out that some of these regional organizations have very small staffs working on issues of disaster, sometimes 3 or 4 or maybe 10 staff people. The names sound really great, but when you start unpacking who's doing what in a huge region, it's actually quite limited. We also hope to engage some of the other regional bodies, Alice, on the question of displacement, building on the AU model to say, what is the role of regional bodies in this respect? And finally, it seems that regional organizations perhaps started looking at response, then stimulated by this Hyogo framework for action in 2005 became much more active in disaster risk reduction, but to our knowledge are doing very little in the third phase of recovery, where it seems that that's either a national or an internationally supported initiative rather than a regional initiative to support long-term recovery. Okay, we got time for another round of questions. I'll take this gentleman here.
Hi, Ben Curran with FEMA here in D.C., and I think getting at what Ian, I think it was, mentioned, not just necessarily in-kind donations, but I think the notion of countries being open to help each other in the response period. I'm just curious what we all know, I think, how we get overwhelmed so easily, of course, with the goods. And even the government-to-government aid, I expect, runs into snafus. What are the prospects for any kind of worldwide campaign at this point, if it isn't in place already, about something along these lines of just encouraging the general public with some easy messaging related to financial contributions, of course. I realize organizations like CIDI, PAHO is a great advocate for this. But maybe our efforts at FEMA would be, strengthened just by doing something more in unity with others. The other question is maybe slightly beyond just the role of regional organizations, but related to recovery tipping points, just more from the international experience perhaps, are there a couple of things off the top of your head that you're aware of, indicators essentially, I think is what I'm getting at, that really show us, demonstrate to us well into the recovery period, what are the indicators that help all of us see the, I guess sometimes we call them recovery tipping points, you know, whereby if we put more effort into such and such, we'd see that the recovery would be more effective or successful. If that's
several hands up. 1, 2, 3. Is this gentleman? Gentleman and Anita and then
I'm Fred Kringgold from the Virginia Tech Disaster Risk Reduction Program. And I'm particularly interested in the potential role of regional organizations as intergovernmental bodies to have influence or make a contribution to the development of regulatory capacity, particularly land use and building regulation at the national and municipal level within the member countries.
Great, thank you. Anita, and then...
Anita Mingetti, Office of U.S. Foreign Assistance Resources, State Department, and I'm in with the bright colors today. I'm actually just going to offer a case study to the question that was just asked, which is what can a regional organization, or in fact, what there still is a big international system, what can the international system do more about, say, Pakistan floods, where we know that the Taliban is denuding the forests and hurting the watershed. We know that land tenure is seriously undermined. We know that wealthy people divert water to where poor people pay. And I'm just wondering, that's one of those political things that we talk, but it is those types of things that impede our ability to really look at mitigation. And just a point that I was thrilled to hear that the regional organizations are looking at other than humanitarian funds for mitigation and preparedness.
Hi there, Michael Halpern with the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Curious what panelists think about how we ensure that regional entities have access to the best available data and information in making decisions regarding resiliency, as well as being able to agree on what sources are most reliable.
Thanks. Let's have a round of responses. Ian, I'll start with you this time, since you get first pick at the questions.
Okay. Let me start with the last one on the question around data. I think certainly coming from the Red Cross perspective, we think there's a tremendous value in establishing regional clearinghouses or regional centers for collecting data. I mean, it seems like, you know, there's so much data in these days that's being developed, and the question of like where it's housed, who has access to it. I mean, these are all becoming more and more critical kind of issues. And I think that's certainly an area that we would see a strong role for regional organizations. And I think we've been very, you know, happy with the access like that the Red Cross even has been able to gain to like data, for example, in Central America through the CAPRA project and others like that, that start to pool data together and make it more accessible. So it seems like clearly that there's a role there. I wanted to jump to the recovery tipping points question as well. I think this is an area from the Red Cross perspective that we're really, I guess, interested too in how we think about market approaches. You know, that so often our notions around humanitarian assistance are kind of a direct assistance model. You know, that understanding how we can indirectly influence recovery activities and how do we help revive economic activity is a really interesting point. You know, I think there's certainly a lot that we could begin to share and learn more around the market approaches and thinking about the World Bank studies in particular around some of the issues that were addressed in Japan after the Fukushima earthquake and tsunami. And the thing that the advanced economies do to kind of look at what's happening economically in their countries and what kind of efforts they make ahead of time or when the disaster's happening to try and address that quite quickly, I think could be quite interesting learning points for thinking about how do we do that in other kinds of economies as well. You know, often we put that aside as something that's not important for 3 or 4 months, but actually I think it's something that will become increasingly important from the very start.
Great. Rosa, and then Cleveland.
Thank you very much. I want to start with the guide to giving, because that's definitely mm-hmm. something that takes up a lot of the time of my team. We have developed different levels of guide to giving. We realized that we needed to have very simple messaging on how to give during disasters for your ordinary citizen, for the private sector, for media to use, for national NGOs, for regional organizations. So we've had to do several level of them, have them translated. We now have them at least in 8 languages. What we do now is that whenever we have a meeting with a regional organization, we take them. Whenever I receive a delegation from a state in New York, I give them out as part of it. So we are constantly looking for opportunities to share because we take for granted people know what to do, and when they don't, it causes major confusion, and nobody can deal with it. It's the biggest headache that we've identified when we're speaking to Brazil, when we're speaking to anybody out there. So at least at the global level, there's a guide to giving. We have in different languages. We make it available to any government, NGO, whoever needs it. It is there. We can give it to you. We've also developed a guide to giving on how to manage your own pool funds because we realize sometimes they don't want to give it to the UN. But if you have your own trust fund or if you have your own NGO, how should you encourage your community to give? Like, for example, please be careful with clothing because it may not always be relevant in the area of disaster. You know, what kind of stuff to give, what you should be asking from your community so that stuff is not wasted out of goodwill. So that also, that we target particularly for community-based organizations and national NGOs and emerging economies. So that also is separate. We have on the 19th of August what we call the World Humanitarian Day. We celebrate it every day, every year. Last year we had Beyonce at the UN General Assembly. This year the planning is going on. We use that as a major awareness day. And one of the biggest shifts that we have to do is move from traditional media to social media because we realize otherwise we're not reaching the right people. So, again, now we have a whole set of tools there that, you know, FEMA, train 3 hours or internet, we can share with you everything that we have. We'll be delighted to. The last thing I would like to say on that is that I was invited to give a speech here to private sector. I think it was like 6 or 8 months ago. They had the same question. And one of our comments to them is that we have such fantastic examples of working with USAID and, you know, around the world on these issues. We should find a way to bring those best practices back so we can actually use them here in the States. So I'm delighted to follow up on that one. I'll leave recovery indicators to you. One last thing that I wanted to touch upon is the access to information. Do regional organizations have access to the right information in time to make the right decision? First of all, it's a major challenge for us. And we're in the center. We're the coordination for humanitarian affairs, and it's a nightmare scenario, I can tell you, any given time. Do they have access? We do it on a case-by-case basis. I was just looking now. We've just completed a handbook for disaster management for Asia-Pacific states, which catalogs for them what are the information management systems available, who has access to what agreements they need to enter into to be able to benefit from the information. We also just concluded a similar discussion with the League of Arab States where they were not aware that they could have access to satellite information because they're actually members of the United Nations. So now we're going to make sure that that is available to them as part of the disaster management systems that is there. We also have a handbook that we're finalizing with the African Union that we expect to be launched in June and July. And last but not least, we have also the regional meeting that we have with the Latin American and Caribbean states, this year in Jamaica. So, again, we're going to figure out with the discussion there what is locally acceptable, what exists and what is missing, what is the added value in terms of knowledge and access to information that would help the decision-making process in that region.
Thanks. Cletus, any brief points?
Yes. First of all, I think I see a role for the rule of law. In both the preventive and the responsive response sides of this issue, I think in the context of the preventive side, the access to information is certainly a critical issue. There are some issues that are on the fringes of the denial of rights, for example, land tenure rights and so on, that place people in positions of increased vulnerability to disasters, that law, the rule of law, a proper standing on the rule of law can help to address. What access do people have to justice in situations like that? On the response side, in the OAS, we have a unique convention, the title of which eludes me all the time, but my colleague Pablo González can help us with that. But it's this convention that intends to regulate the response of regional international agencies to disaster situations at the national level. And unfortunately, that convention was not invoked heavily in the Haiti situation. I believe if it was, we might have had a more ordered response situation there. But to come back on the point about the harmonization of public policies that was made early on and the access to dates and so on, I think this is one thing that we can, as regional organizations, do to help governments, is to mainstream risk management in the development planning arrangements. If we can get that going, then I think we will have an opportunity to hit not just the preventive side, but the recovery side and the response side and everything else, to ensure that going forward in these situations, that states are building resilience and not deepening their vulnerability.
Thank you. Let's take just a few more, and if you can be very brief, we'll do 1, 2, 3, and then I'll ask the respondents to be very brief so we can close in 8 minutes.
Hi, I'm Karen Walsh from Blue Glass Development, and this question more is resilience and private sector intervention. A lot of the problems we have is that we don't see the economic data because of the non-sharing of anything from a tourism industry designated island all the way to a major metropolitan like New York City. You don't want to share that data because you don't want to get your investors spooked. You don't want to get your tourists not to come. So how do we change that? How do we make it imperative that the private sector within that nation, country, is understanding, and almost to your point of how do they play part of the planning so that they know that the data is there, and if they're part of the process, they'll receive it so they can be part of the solution.
Great. Thank you. Yes, want to?
Hi, Kate Longhurst from the Australian Embassy. I just had a quick question. You mentioned, as we see this trend develop, that some organisations may have pre-existed looking at the disaster relief and response part of their work. My question is actually about the organisations themselves. Are they structured in the best way? Is the system of those organisations working to an ideal? Or is there a part of the world that simply doesn't have enough of them or isn't covered, or similarly part of the world that has too many of the regional organizations looking at this topic?
Thank you. And last question, at the back.
Mm-hmm. Abby Rule with Interaction. In your first opening comments, you had mentioned the role of regional organizations and their interface with the military, especially now that we're kind of seeing the U.S. pivot towards Southeast Asia with more disaster response, preparedness, mitigation. So it's just kind of wondering your thoughts on the roles of regional organizations in terms of interfacing and working with the military on their kind of non-traditional roles.
Okay, Cletus, would you like to start, or Rosa? Don't feel like you have to try to answer all of them.
Rosa. Let me start with the last one. On the role of military assets, I think that we need to first of all recognize that there's been an evolution, and a lot of the emerging economies or emerging states see their military assets as number one, if not number two, tool to contribute to humanitarian situations. This is not helped by the fact that on a bilateral basis, they have agreements with those that we call our traditional partners who train those military for humanitarian response. We call it hearts and minds or whatever you want to call it. So if we have to acknowledge that they're going to be there, they have the assets, they got resources, they're just going to be there, then it becomes absolutely paramount that a code of conduct is clear. I think that the whole discussion about whether they're going to be there, we lost that one a long time ago. But we need to discuss roles of engagement, rules and responsibility. Coordination arrangements is absolutely paramount. that it's clear what role they do, whether it's a facilitation role, because sometimes the natural disasters happen in very sensitive contexts already. So the flood will be here. It's gone tomorrow. We still need to stay behind and deal with the IDPs. So it's context specific, but I really think roles and responsibilities is critical. I'm a very strong supporter of having centers of excellence. I think it's important to have a place where we're not under a deadline, where we can have a discussion about implications and mandates, because sometimes they just don't know. They don't understand better. Red Cross, UN, what are you talking about? So we can have that kind of discussion in a non-stressful fashion going forward. And I also think that if you're going to start training military of other countries, then please, you need to take this into consideration. Sometimes we have found that our colleagues in USAID just didn't know the other arm of the government was doing that. So internal coordination within the U.S. government when interacting outside will help all of us to make sure we remain coherent on the principles that we're all pushing for at different levels. On the RO structures feasibility numbers, and I know, thank you, Australia, for giving us all that money to work with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Just remember that. I think that we cannot have a one-size-fits-all. It is true that each of these organizations were born in different circumstances. Having said that, for different reasons, they're all adapting. And from what I have seen going around, they're adapting to their own realities. The question is, with all the few reforms that we are going through, are we going through the right ones to make sure that we are a nimble, effective, fit-for-purpose global custodian to be able to interface with these region organizations and the members that they have, their shareholders? Okay.
Cletus, and then Ian, and then I'll say thank you.
Yes, a quick point on, militaries and the Americas have a long, tenuous history. And in that context, there are good and bad aspects of military involvement in post-disaster situations. But I agree entirely that a code of conduct, and we have something coming close to that without the Convention on International Disaster Assistance or Post-Disaster Assistance, that sets out a blueprint in terms of behavior, in terms of registration and things of that sort. That could be a sort of blueprint for others to follow. On the issue of the private sector and the access to data, I think I do believe though that the there are ways in which the private sector information can be accessed. What is of concern to me mostly is that the private sector sometimes does not, especially the reinsurance agencies, have not made their data available. And that is compromising very greatly our ability to design proper risk transfer systems for all of these countries, because that information is not available. And they're not keen to make it available.
Ian?
I'll take a stab at the private sector data one also. The other thing I think we could do better is, you know, oftentimes after disasters, the World Bank or either together with the UNDP or together with other regional development banks will lead a post-disaster needs assessment. You know, I think there's definitely more we could do in terms of differentiating between damage and loss. Like, in many ways, this is all modeled as if damage is certainly usually happened by the time the assessment's being done. The losses are something that are projected going forward based on that damage. But I think the question of, like, you know, could we do more to model different kinds of recovery interventions to look at how that might impact losses is something that's not a strong suit yet in how we think about that kind of assessment. And that might be something that would be a good possibility for public-private partnership. I mean, for, you know, the large private sector companies in affected areas to work with the government on looking at, you know, how do we think about the losses under different scenarios, you know, really trying to test out different kinds of strategies and approaches to recovery. You know, as I think right now it's more of a, you know, there's one kind of straight formula for how losses are calculated, and we would do better actually, given that they haven't actually occurred yet, you know, to think about how they might be projected in different ways depending on different kinds of interventions we might undertake. And that might be a good way to involve the private sector locally in these areas and thinking about what kind of different policies on the part of local government and what kind of actions by private sector companies themselves might help influence, you know, how economies recover and how do we limit losses going forward so that they're not the maximum amount that we could assume.
Yeah, and into the, also to the question from Australia on different models or mechanisms, it seems easier to get regional bodies to act on technical issues, develop an early warning system, or provide specialized knowledge than on some of other issues that may be seen as more political. And also these organizations differ so much in terms of national capacities. I mean, why would a Thailand ask ASEAN with its staff, ASEAN Center for Humanitarian Affairs with its staff of 10 or 12, why would they ask ASEAN for assistance when the floods occur, when they've got hundreds of people who are trained to respond? In the Pacific Islands, it might be very different, where Vanuatu needs Pacific regional organizations in a different way. There's still lots of questions, I know, but our time has come to an end. And thank all of you for your patience and the panelists for joining us for our discussion.